Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Trundlebed Tales. This is your host, Sarah Utoff, and tonight's episode is going to be about maple syrup. We had technical trouble last week, and hopefully everything will be straightened out here, and we'll get our guests talking real soon. But before we get to that, I want to make sure everybody here feels welcome to Trundlebed Tales, the podcast about Laura Ingalls Wilder, historic foodways, one-room schools, and other social history. This is Sarah Utoff, the host and creator of Trundlebed Tales. Find us around the web under Trundlebed Tales and on your favorite social media platform. If you listen or just have an account on iTunes, please leave positive feedback because that helps people find the show. This is episode 86 of Trundlebed Tales, with Lynn Beluskill and the maple syrup history. And I am going to go ahead and because I think it is time for housekeeping.
But if you hear that sound, which is the noise made by washing metal plates in a metal wash tub on the stove, then you know it's time for a little housekeeping. And here on Trundlebed Tales, our housekeeping means giving you the information you may need about the show. If you ever want to listen to an episode live, but you don't want to just stream it through the computer, you can call in at 714-242-5253. That's 714-242-5253. Or toll free 1-877-633-9389. That's toll free 1-877-633-9389. You can also use those same numbers to call in and ask a question and otherwise be on the show.
Okay, Lynn, thank you. I'm glad I got a hold of you.
Yeah, so am I.
And that it seems to be working this week. Now, that was what was going on with my little housekeeping spiel. I was just telling everybody. Everybody out there, I gave you the number. So if you have a question, you can call in. I also have opened the chat room. So if anybody wants to ask a question that way, they can. And we are going to, I think that's going to wind up our housekeeping, and then we will get right back to Lynn. So let me just close up. Okay, now that gets us back to our guest today, which is Lynn. And why don't we start out with you just going ahead and introducing yourself a little bit.
Well, my name is Lynn Beluscio. I live in Leroy, New York, which is probably going to be remembered. Everybody will remember. It's the home of Jell-O. And so I'm the director of the Historical Society in Leroy and also the Jell-O Museum, the one and only. But I think why you and I are talking is because when my husband and I moved here, from Rochester when we were first married, one of the first things we did was we built a sugar house, and we were in the maple syrup business. I say that because my husband worked for Kodak and I was teaching, but we boiled maple syrup for many, many years.
The Jell-O part, I was hesitating because I was trying to think how much of the Jell-O stuff I should say, but we maybe want to save that for another time. But
we'll have to talk about Jell-O sometime.
Yes, Lynn is known far and wide for her for Jell-O things. And really, the stuff they have done there, I mean, just from the pictures I have seen, it's quite remarkable. You even have a little Jell-O wagon, right? That's the
yes. We it's actually mine. It doesn't belong to the museum, and but there is a kind of a little bit of a correlation. Somewhat sad, I guess, in some ways. But my husband passed away back in 1996, and of course I live in the middle of maple woods. Obviously, that's why we have the sugar house. And part of our job, if anybody has a sugar bush, as they call it, is you have to trim it. I mean, you have to keep those trees nice and healthy. And so after my husband died, and we actually by that time I'd sort of gotten out of the sugar business because it takes quite a bit of work, and it's not something you can really do alone. So it came a couple years, and I thought, well, I really need to trim out some of these trees and some of the maple trees, and it was sad to see them go, but we knew that it would be for the health of the sugar bush to do that. And so we cut down, I had a forester come in, and we cut down some maple trees, and I had the money, and I thought, gee, you know, what should I do with that? And actually, I used the money from cutting, you know, some of the maple trees to build my Jell-O wagon, a horse-drawn Jell-O wagon, because we showed horses. I have a black Morgan Stallion, and we used to drive them on carriages, and one of the classes was what they called commercial classes, and we always wanted to have a Jell-O wagon, so I had one made out in Xenia, Ohio, and so, yes, I have a Jell-O wagon, but like I said, there's a little bit of a story there with the maple trees.
And it's sort of connected to Laura, too, because it's a Morgan, and everybody knows that Almanzo had Morgans.
Yes, right. Yep, yeah.
Oh, okay.
We bought our first Morgan, when my daughter was 12, and my husband really liked it and started driving, and he called it his therapy, and we never collected sap with our horse. That was, we always used a tractor we collected by hand, but... we've retired him now. He's 28. He was a grand champion, beautiful fellow, and he's standing down at the barn right now, even as we speak, waiting for supper eventually. So.
Okay. Now, I think you said that your background with maple syrup goes back further than your own sugar bush.
Oh, yeah, a couple generations. My mother's folks were from central New York, both southern tier area, and then she had a sister, my aunt, who lived up north, and of course the other connection up, they went over to Malone all the time, and that was the other connection that you and I had talked about, and they were marginal farmers, and I remember as a kid going up to their farm. I think they might have milked maybe at the most, maybe 18 cows. And my Uncle Carlton had a sugar bush, and that was one of the things you do is you go up in January, February to visit the relatives and go hang out at the sugar house. And a sad story about that was that when they moved from the farm and sold the farm, one of the things that they did, because they, like I said, they were pretty marginal farmers. I know that my uncle had a tractor, but I don't think it ever ran. He did all his farming pretty much with horses. And they were pretty hard-strapped to get their kids through college. So they cut down their sugar bush to the local bowling pin company. There was a company up there that would turn maple trees into bowling pins. And so I still remember that story of having him cut down his sugar bush for bowling pins.
Well, that is
but then
sad.
My mother's cousin who lives south of Syracuse, I think that was easier to get to than going up into the North Country at that time of the year. And he had a sugar bush, and like I said, that was one of the things that we always did was to go down during sugar season and hang around out at the walk up to the sugar house. And and when we were first married, my husband, he was a city kid, so that was horses and sugaring was something new to him. And so we went up there, and he said, gee, that'd be kind of neat. And so we came back. In fact, my mother's cousin, his name was Ikey, we actually he gave us some of the family's old wooden sugar buckets and buckets. And we had about 20 of them, and I still got about 10 of them, I guess. And because when we first started, my husband and I first started sugaring, it was one of these, we had a, you know, kind of a campfire and a wash tub out in the backyard, well, out in the woods. And and we hung, I still remember the first time we tapped, we had bought some spiles, some metal spiles, and we put those in the trees to collect sap. And we kind of underestimated, you know, what we were going to collect in. And we went to our, we had one of those nesting camp cook sets, you know, that had the three or four pots that were all nesting in each other, and they all had bales. And we had all of our camp cooking equipment hanging on our trees. And we, I think we had maybe 10 trees tapped or something of the sort. And we collected sap in that for the first year. And then we decided we better do something better, and that was when we got the wooden buckets. And and that was always a chore, and anybody that's ever collected in wooden buckets know that the first thing you have to do is you have to soak them. And, of course, my my mother's cousin would always, they'd put them in the creek, and so they'd soak up and swell up so they wouldn't leak. Well, we didn't have that, so we, for the first several years, when we were still using the wooden buckets, our bathtub was always filled with sap buckets for three, 4 days until they all swelled up. And that was part of the I guess that chore that people don't realize that you have to do. And and of course the problem with wooden buckets with the wide mouth on top, they fill with snow. So you have to, we had went out and we bought the tin lids that go over the top to keep the snow and rain out of them. And so, you know, we, it kind of gradually grew from, you know, 10, 12 spiles, and then we were up to 24. And my husband would come home from work, and he'd go down to the into the woods, because, like I said, we didn't have a sugar house at that time. And he'd sit there with we had two galvanized tubs, you know, wash tubs, and he would boil in one and then finish off in the other. He'd sit down there in the snow and the rain, hunkered down on a tree stump. With at that time we had a big Irish setter, and the dog would go down and sit next to him, and they'd sit down there and tend the fires, and until we had something that was close to syrup, and then we'd bring it back up to the house and finish it off. But then it kept expanding. He really enjoyed that. It gave us something to do at that time of the year, and so he decided he was going to build a sugar house, and we built a sugar house, and that was quite a project. It wasn't a real big one. It was kind of, you know, let's see, I don't know what it is. It must be about maybe 20 by 16. And we purchased a small evaporator, a commercial evaporator. It was wood-fired. And I was thinking today, because I knew you were going to call, I was trying to think back those first couple years. We had a dirt floor in that sugar house, which was a problem. It wasn't so bad when the beginning of the season started, because the floor would be kind of hard. But then as it got started to thaw out, then it'd get kind of muddy, and then it'd get really dusty. And then we had a resident woodchuck who, in fact, he's still down there, I know, or at least his great-great-grandchildren are. And about when it came time for him to kind of wake up after hibernation, he would dig a hole right up through the floor of the sugar house. And we'd go down in the morning, and here would be a big pile of dirt, and he will have emerged from his winter sleep right in the middle of the sugar house. And so at that point, we Bob decided he would put in a cement floor, and that was a little bit of modernization. But we still had kerosene lamps down there, and we were wood-fired for a long time. And so that was another part of the chore, was to split and have enough wood to go through sugar season. And there was a lot of firewood that we handled. And, of course, off the side of the sugar house would be a shed for all that wood to season, because you'd have to cut it the year before, so it'd be seasoned for the next year. So that was part of the project. People kind of, they romanticize about, you know, making maple sugar or maple syrup. There's a lot of work involved.
There is.
Yep.
I know. But let's kind of back up here for people who are listening who maybe haven't dealt with the process before. So what exactly is maple syrup?
Well, maple syrup is actually it's a sugar that is derived from maple trees. You can get some sap from other trees you can use, but most everybody, you know, likes the maple flavor and the maple sugar. So it's kind of interesting historically because, you know, there's, and I don't think everybody really agrees, but we know that the Iroquois Indian in this area, they were they knew about the sap being sweet from maple trees, and there are Indian names and Indian lore about the use of that and how it started. And of course, before they had metal pots and kettles to boil it down in, they would heat up stones and actually plunge those hot stones into wooden or bark containers to boil off the water. Now the sap only comes up and it does come up from the roots of the tree when it starts to warm up in the spring, and so the sap starts going up the tree in the layer just under the bark, and so the object is to drill a hole or tap or slash, and the process changed historically. To get the sap to drip out, and you'd collect the sap, and like I said, you want to drive the water off. And you know, early settlers, that was a source of sweetening. In some cases, we know that some of the early pioneers even talked about that they basically lived on maple sugar at that time of the year because there was nothing else. I mean, that was before the you know, anything was growing, and so lots of times they were relegated to the spring to tapping those trees and getting, you know, some sugar. And so it takes, they average, and it really depends. There's a lot of science to this in some cases. But it usually averages about 40 gallons of sap to make a gallon of syrup. And so you've got to boil off 39 gallons of water. And at the beginning of the season, and again, that depends on where you are. This was a really lousy season for syrup. I mean, I feel sorry for anybody that was involved with maple syrup this year because it warmed up, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But you know, you want to tap as soon as they say when the sap runs, it's interesting again because some of this is folk tales, but. You know, they'll say when you start seeing the crows fly, or you know, certain things in nature will give you an indication that it's time to tap. But of course, the best thing is to go out and drill a hole in the tree. But what you need is a warm day and very cold nights. And if you have a really warm spell, like we had this last year here, around here, is it warmed up and it didn't go below freezing at night. So the sap doesn't drive up from the ground. But the early sap, the first run is what they call it. The first run is usually the sweetest. Your sugar content in the first run is usually got a higher sugar content. And that's really what you want because you don't have to boil it as much. It doesn't take 40 gallons to one. It might be 35, might be even less sometimes. Of course, in the old days, they didn't have the equipment to measure it, but, you know, we use hydrometers to figure out, you know, what the sugar content is. But the longer that the sap boils, you don't want the sap to spend a lot of time boiling because it actually starts to caramelize that that sugar. And so the first run usually was the lightest and what was the best. And again, here's some more of the, you know, the story that, quote unquote, in the old days, they wanted their maple sugar to be like white sugar. And so you paid more for white sugar maple sugar that didn't have much of a maple flavor because it was very much like white sugar. And so they would call that grade A. And so it sounded like it was a quality. It really had much more to do with the flavor and the color. And you grade maple syrup by its color. And so old grading systems, and actually you have four or five little bottles, and in each one is a color of liquid, and you match your syrup to that, and that'll tell you whether it's grade A, grade B, or what they call table grade in the old days. Well, people said, well, gee, we want to have the grade A, and they'd get it, and they'd put it on their pancakes, and they'd say, well, this doesn't have any flavor. Well, that's because that was the first run. And so it didn't have much of a maple flavor. So about maybe 30 years ago, maybe not quite that long ago, a lot of the commercial syrup growers association, they changed the grading system. So today when you buy syrup, it's usually according to the color. So you buy light amber, dark amber. So it doesn't, you buy it according to the color. The darker the color, usually the more robust the flavor, and a lot of people like that. Most of the people that I know that boil and make maples, they like that delicate flavor of that first run. But it's an acquired taste because it's not that strong, maple-y flavor. So some of those stories are, like I said, based on what our pioneer folks wanted once they wanted that white sugar. And they would not boil it down. They would take it past syrup. When you're making maple syrup, you boil it to a certain level. It has to be a certain density. You can measure that. If you take it too far, as they say, you take it too far, it'll crystallize and you'll get sugar crystals in the bottom of the jar or the jug. So that's really critical. But the thing was that syrup didn't keep. And if you didn't have the technology or the equipment to can it, for example, you didn't take it to syrup. You took it further. You took it to maple sugar. And so if you look at the store records of people, farmers coming in and selling eggs and butter and cheese and things like that, they were selling maple sugar. They were not selling maple syrup at the local store, and because it was easier to keep. You would boil it, and then you could either pour it into molds, wooden molds, that would be like little bricks that you could pound it because it would be quite hard, or you could stir it so that it was, I wouldn't say it's granulated, but it's, you could take a spoon and go into it. And again, my uncle who did genealogy and my mother's family talked about my great-grandmother and grandfather back, this had to have been in the 1870s, I believe, how many pounds of maple sugar they stirred that winter. I mean, a lot, because it was a source of income for them. But they would boil it down, put it in a big wooden trough, and then you just stir the living daylights out of it. You got to keep stirring, otherwise it'll set up and be hard as a brick. Sort of the same way you make maple candy. But again, those are all some of the differences between then and now. I mean, people cook with maple syrup today, but in those days they would have cooked with maple sugar. And the tapping system has changed. We used to try the old ways. We had some old wooden spiles. In fact, my husband enjoyed trying to make some because you got to hollow them out. And they're usually pretty long. And the reason is that before people had buckets, they would make containers out of usually split basswood logs. They'd take basswood and maybe cut it in 2-foot lengths, maybe a little bit shorter. And then you'd hollow out and make a trough out of it. And so the spile that would go into the tree would hang out maybe a foot, and the sap would drip in onto the trough that was on the ground. And that was again a job that men were hired to do. They would you know, say how many saptras they had made during the winter to collect sap. And we tried it once or twice, and I remember at Old Sturbridge Village, Washington, they collected it up there the same way. And you lose a lot of it. The wind blows a little bit, and the sap kind of blows away, doesn't hit the trough on the ground. And so you can see why, you know, technology, the introduction of metal pails was really important because it was easier to collect. And and the whole, you know, there are people that collect sap spiles. You know, I guess it's like a lot of other things that people collect. There were all different kinds of patented sap spiles. Some of the early gash systems, which really were more injurious to the tree, they actually would take a, it's maybe 2 inches, 3 inches gouge, and they'd actually gouge the tree. And then they would put in a metal, flat piece of metal. It would, to me, it looks like a tire iron from a wagon. And they'd put that in the tree and collect the sap. One of the funny stories about upstate New York is that in the, I believe in the 1700s, the men that came here thought that they could make a pretty good living out of making maple sugar. And so they, in fact, they even came up with an idea that they would hollow out wooden logs. They would split the log, a small log, and then make a trough in it, and they would collect the sap in a series of these troughs. The problem was that when they tried that, the sun would hit those wooden troughs and they would warp, and so they'd lose all their sap. But the other thing that they didn't realize was that the sugar season was really only maybe 2 months, 2.5 months. The sap didn't run all year long, so their business venture didn't really work out too well. But they thought there was good money to be had that way, and I think I was telling you one of the great history stories about during the period of slavery. There were the abolitionists, of course, did not want anybody to use white sugar, the white cone sugar that was available, because it was produced by slave labor in the Indies. And so there was, they said, you know, the only sugar you should use is that's untainted by slave hands. And so there was a lot of interest in increasing the sugar production, maple sugar production at that time. It was simultaneous with the thought that maybe they could make use sugar beets to make beet sugar too, but the abolitionists were really encouraging people to use maple sugar, which was kind of interesting. But so yeah, it gets to be about, you know, the end of January, and you know, it's time to go out and tap those trees, and there's nothing quite like it. We used to have people come to the sugar house, and they would always ask for a mug of sap because they thought it was spring tonic to drink some of that maple sap before we boiled it. So, yeah.
Okay, so we've gotten the maple trees. It's the right kind of year, so the sap's flowing, and then we
yep.
have a spile. The early
mm-hmm.
ones were, you know, kind of long and wood, but later, but
mm-hmm.
Most of them were metal then because that
metal,
was easier.
Right?
And the buckets were early on, they were wood, and you would soak them
so that
the wood would stay in a circle and kind of swell up.
Well, the wood would swell because during the summer the wood would dry out and the bucket would leak.
We've got to the metal ones. Okay, so that's where we are in the process. So the next thing
we're going to
go through and collect all the sap, which which, as you said, it's like 40 gallons of sap to one of maple syrup. So it isn't quite as sweet as I think people who haven't had this experience think it is. But it's, you know, it's like sweetened water with a little sugar in it.
And I would say for the most part, most people would probably maybe have a glass of sap and not realize there was really much sugar at all in it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it might be 1 or 2%. It's really pretty low.
Yeah. So it isn't really like maple syrup is. It's
not at all. No. It looks like water.
Yes. So then the next step would be gathering up the sap, and they used to use, you know, horses, and it'd have like, oh, I don't know, did they have a tank they'd pull behind the horses?
Well,
or?
Yeah, they would collect with horses. We used to, when we first did it, in fact, we used to collect with neck yokes, because I would swear that, because there were special pails that you would pour the sap into that were larger than what was hanging on the tree. And they might be, oh, golly, I'm going to say maybe 5-6 gallons. And they're pretty heavy. I always swore that my arms were going to get about 2-3 inches longer every syrup season, because you'd hang, you know, two pails on it. So at that point, we found out that using a neck yoke to carry sap from the trees to the collecting tank was a good way to do it. So we kind of did it the old way there for a while. And then that you would fill the tank. And there are beautiful wooden ones that have, you know, remained that might hold, oh, golly, I don't know, maybe 50, 75 gallons. And then you'd bring that back to the sugar house. And then you would, you know, drain the sap from the tank into what we call the evaporator. And various kinds of evaporators. I mean, in the old days, it was just two, you know, maybe a big iron kettle that you would boil the water off. And that's, you know, in the wonderful old cuts, they show, you know, a party out in the woods, and they've got one of those big iron kettles, and they just keep adding sap to it and waiting for it to, you know, boil down to maple syrup. Yeah.
Now, I was going to ask about that. As you do see people continuing to add sap to it,
yep.
But so you don't do it sort of like as one batch and get it boiled down where you need to. You just keep kind of pouring more fresh in.
Well, I know that what we did was that we basically would, let's say we're going to boil on a day, on a Saturday. So you'd start and you collect in the morning, because sometimes it would take, you know, it'd be maybe, I mean, that was, we used to keep track in a diary of, you know, when the sap was up. And sometimes the sap would run at 10 in the morning. Sometimes it would be 1 o'clock in the afternoon before you go collect sap. And you don't want the sap to sit around, because if it's not cold enough, it starts to work, because it's got sugar in it. It starts going bad. And so you want fresh sap. And so let's say you collect enough sap to start, but you might not have enough. I mean, you want to finish off a couple gallons at a time. So you keep adding, you know, sap to it. We frequently, when we were boiling it, there were some times we boiled well until wee hours of the morning, because we wanted to finish off that day, you know, the collection of that day. And so we would, you know, boil maybe until midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning. There were times when we boiled all night long, because you want to boil fresh sap. And there were times, and I can remember, you know, usually once a year in sugar season, the sap would run all night, and you just couldn't keep up with it. And, of course, the last thing you want to do is pour sap out. But there were a couple times when it was going to spoil, and we didn't want to taint the good syrup with bad sap. It turns cloudy, has a terrible smell, and it, like I said, it starts to ferment, starts to work. And so we would basically do one day's batch. Now, of course, that's changed a lot today, and maple syrup business today is a lot different than it used to be. But yeah, I mean, it was one day, and you might boil 2 or 3 days in a row, and then it would get really cold and it would stop, and you might have to wait a couple of days and then wait for the sap to come up the tree again. And, like I said, one of my prized possessions is about 15 years of notes that my husband would take. He would put down the overnight temperature, the temperature in the morning, the time that the sap started coming up the tree, how much we collected, and how much we would draw off at the end of the day.
Well, it sounds like that was it was a lot of work. I guess I hadn't realized that it was such a start and stop business. I was kind of thinking that it ran until it quit and that was it.
No, it was start and go. And we would always, you know, that was, you never knew how long a season would be. And we would keep track of that also, because you could start in January, you could get a real hard freeze and you might not boil again for maybe 3 weeks. And then you'd boil for a couple of days and then it would freeze back up again. And then you might have, and one of the problems there is that, if it warmed up, see, if you put your taps in January, for example, if you're still boiling in March, the spile holes start to get bad. They start to get just like the sap, they start turning bad. And so the worst thing that can happen to you is you got to go around and you've got to re-drill those holes. You don't want that to happen. So that's another thing that people don't realize is that sometimes the saps, in fact, when the sap would really get bad, it would actually clog up the spiles, so that it was like Vaseline. I don't know how else to describe it. It was just goopy, and yeah. You'd have to go pull the spiles, clean out the hole, maybe re-drill it a little bit, and put the spile back in. And and people don't, you know, those are all things that you kind of have to consider about doing. And I remember a couple of years the spiles closed up. I mean, because once you pull that spile out at the end of the season, that the tree starts to grow back in and fill the hole in. And so that's something that, I mean, the tree wants to do that. It wants to close up that wound. And it can start doing that during the season, and that can be a real problem.
But it doesn't hurt the tree long term, right?
There's all sorts of, you shouldn't have so many. It depends on the size of the tree, how many taps you should have in it, and you don't tap in the same spot that you tapped last year, that's another kind of interesting thing about cutting maple trees that are in a sugar bush is the fact that when a forester comes in and they want to cut maple trees for maple lumber, if you've got a sugar bush, you lose about 3 foot up from the stump, maybe even more, that they can't use, because you've got, if you were to cut that tree and look at the cross section, you can see where all the spiles were. And that was always neat at my mother's uncle's place, because they would, they had some huge big trees that probably were, 200 years old or something of the sort, and they'd been tapped for probably 100 years. And when they were cut down, you could see, all the spile marks where they'd been tapped, year after year after year. But you probably, a tree maybe, I'd have to go back and check to make sure. But usually a tree that's about 20 inches in diameter, you might put two spiles in it. But you don't want to injure the tree, and that's part of the problem too. So, yeah. But and then, like I said, once you start boiling, then you've got to keep track, because you can burn it. It can be burning boiling so much that it goes into sugar so quick that it'll burn all of a sudden you look in there and you got black tar. I don't know how else to describe it. And so usually most people, when they're making maple syrup, they will they will finish it off in a finishing pan. They'll have sugar bushes, they'll finish it off in the house. You have to be careful, because you do too much of that boiling, if you got any wallpaper, it'll come right off your walls. But it's like having a steamer.
And that was something I was going to say too. That's why you have the sugar house separately. I don't know how many of those listening have dealt with boiling things off, but if you do, it's very humid. It's like when you're trying to can things in the summer. And on top of that, since this is not just water, it's syrup, there's that sugar element. So it gets on things. And it deposits all over the walls. It deposits all over the floor. It deposits everywhere. So you do want this in your kitchen, your nice house.
If you have, you know, if your house needs some humidity in the wintertime, it's good for a little bit. But, you know, to finish it off in the house, I mean, you don't want to, you know, put that much water into the atmosphere in your house. You can run into problems. But, and like I said, most people have what they call finishing pans, and they're usually, you know, tin, maybe stainless steel, but usually our evaporators, the finishing pans were always dipped tin, English tin. And God forbid that you'd burn them, because boy, it was hard cleaning that burned sugar off.
And you'd
lose the whole batch. You'd lose, you know, and that was the worst thing that could happen. You know, and I'd be up at the house, and I could tell immediately, oh my gosh, they burned the pan, because you could smell it up to the house.
Yeah.
And then they'd have to take the evaporator down in the woods and put water in it and scrub it down, because you had to get rid of every little bit of charring on it, because otherwise it would flavor the syrup and give you a burn flavor.
Yeah, so, which is not good.
Yeah, but the evaporator, you know, they started introducing evaporators, which I'm in the middle of the 1800s, and farmers could buy evaporators, everybody, you know, had a better idea of how to do that. But they're basically huge, big, flat pans. They talk about having flues in them, and what it is, it's like a corrugated bottom. I mean, it goes up and down. What you're trying to do is expose the sap to as much surface as you can. And so, you know, the bottom isn't just always flat in what they refer to as the back pan. And so that, you know, you wanted to get a nice rolling boil. And then the sugar houses were built with vents in the top so that the steam would go out through the top. And then there were regulators that would regulate the amount of sap, because you'd boil it off in the back pan. It would get to a certain density, and then it would automatically fill the front pan, which is the finishing pan. And that was all controlled by a little floating device, which was kind of handy, but woe be you if the float got stuck. I mean, you have to watch it all the time. We used to go down to the sugar house, and it was like they say watch pot doesn't boil, but if you don't keep watching what's going on in the sugar house in that evaporator, you can run into trouble in a big hurry. So, it's like watching go in the sugar house, it's sort of like, I guess, watching grass grow. I mean, you're just watching the pot boil to make sure that it doesn't burn or that everything's going okay. Like I said, I think that most people that have gotten involved with making maple syrup, I guess you can say it's in your blood, but that time of the year, the weather starts getting, and you think, geez, I need to go and tap the trees and collect some sap and boil it down. And there's a wonderful, aroma of boiling sap that is it's a breath of spring, I guess we say. So.
Well, one thing in The Little House in the Big Woods, where Laura's talking about going through this making maple syrup process, they talk about having a big dance. And you'd said that your family, you know, went to visit relatives when they were doing that. Was having some kind of entertainment sort of a normal thing that would happen?
Well, I think that, I don't remember ever my mother's cousins dancing, but, it's like, what do you do when, you know, everybody's sitting around, you know, stoking the fires, because you got to keep the fire going. Somebody might have a harmonica, you know, they might be, you know, telling stories, that sort of thing. It was a time, there wasn't much else to do that time of year, and so it was a time to kind of get together. And I think all the people that remember the, you know, sugar time, it was with great fondness of families getting together, friends getting together. It was like a, you know, it was like a barn raising or a bee. You'd get together and you know, everybody bring a, you know, a dish to pass. Maybe have we had many meals down in the sugar house because we sugared with a neighbor, and his wife would call and she'd say, "What are we gonna do for supper?" And we'd put together some supper and go down, and the four of us would have supper down in the sugar house. We also had a good friend, and I'm sure this isn't in the story of Little House on the Prairie, but we were in the big woods, that we had a friend that would always bring us Maple House or Sugar House Manhattans, which is a, you know, alcoholic beverage that instead of using it's made with maple syrup, which is kind of interesting. So we would have those before dinner, and then we always knew that it was getting towards the end of the season because we would switch to gin and tonic. But you know, it was just part of the, I guess, the whole socialization of having the sugar house and being down there, sitting around the fire. My mother's cousin one time talked about they were running out of firewood, and they stoked the fire with some railroad ties. Well, the creosote in the railroad ties was so hot, got that fire, it almost melted the front iron doors on their evaporator. They watched the iron doors glow because the fire was so hot. I guess they came close to burning up their evaporator pan too. But no, it was a time for, you know, the kids to come and they helped collect. That was, you know, that was a lot of work to collect all that sap. So the kids, I'm sure, were sent out to help collect, you know, sap and bring it to the sugar house. So my kids grew up, you know, that's what you did in January and February. You go down and see how Dad was doing down at the sugar house, and sit there and, you know, kind of enjoy the fire and try to stay warm. And there was no TV, you know.
Well, that's true. If you were in a place that wasn't that your house wasn't the best insulated, I imagine that I can imagine how warm a sugar shack would be in comparison, because you just have to have it going to keep it up to boil. I mean, that would have to be a big fire all the time.
It was always funny because every so often there'd be what we call an inversion, and the steam would not go up through the roof, and it would kind of hunker down. And it would usually come down about neck level, and you couldn't see anything. It was like being in a cloud. And it had to do with some, you know, change in the atmospheric pressure or something of sort, or the wind direction. But it was always funny because it was always, you know, you end up kind of hunkering down because there was nothing you could do to, you know, get it to go out until the wind changed or whatever it is. But so that was always kind of funny. And then we used to cook in the evaporator. We used to boil hot dogs in the back because you just toss a couple hot dogs. Oh, that and hard boiled eggs. We take an egg and put it in the back pan, or you could, you know, hard boil your eggs back there until the time there were two eggs that we never did find. We don't know whatever happened to them. I don't think they got lost. I think they just kind of pulverized or something of the sort. But we used to cook in the evaporator. You know. Yeah, yeah. And that, and of course, the other story, and I have to be honest with you, does Laura talk about making jack wax?
Not by that
name. Does she talk about, okay, what it is you boil the sap to a certain level. It's not, it's a little bit thicker than syrup, okay?
Uh-huh.
And so they would take dishes of fresh snow and pound it so that it was nice and hard, and then you would pour the hot syrup, and like I said, it's thicker than regular. It's like softball candy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But if you pour it on the snow, and you could pour your, you know, you could write your initials, you could write your name, you could make designs, and then it was like eating taffy. It was so good.
Yes, you talked about that. She just called it maple syrup candy. What did you say you called it?
It's called jack wax. Jack wax.
Huh.
And it's so good. In fact, just talking about it, thinking, oh, my gosh, I need to go make some. But we don't have any snow anymore up here. It's all melted. But so good. That, and then you have to have that, and then you got to have the jar of dill pickles because it's so sweet. You need something to, you know. So you have Jack Wax and dill pickles.
So I'm not going to let you get off that easy. I want more instructions on this Jack Wax. So you said you pound the snow hard. You don't usually. It isn't just like light snow that you pick up.
Well, it's got to be fairly hard. It's got to have a fairly hard surface. Otherwise, if you put the hot maple syrup on it, it will, you know, it'll go right through the snow. So you take and you pack snow really hard, you know, so it's like a snowball, except that you fill a, you know, you fill a pan with it or a cake pan or something with it. And you, I mean, you can use crushed ice, okay? But you know, in the wintertime, you got clean snow, you do that. And then you have to, you can't do that in the evaporator. You kind of have to make it in a separate pan. But you take some maple syrup and you start to boil it. And you can use a candy thermometer if you, you know, if you want to get technical about it. And so I off the top of my head, I can't remember the temperature. But it's basically the softball candy. You know, I don't know if you've ever... Yeah, you know, and you pour the sugar into the ice water, and it's sometimes, you know that it's ready to go because it, okay, well, you do the same thing with maple syrup. And when it starts to, you know, it's not going to turn it into really hard candy, but it's going to be just before it turns into hard candy, you pour it on, you drizzle it onto the snow. And we used to, you know, we used to write the kids' names, you know, or we would make, you know, designs with it, you know, swizzle it onto the snow, and then you'd eat it. Oh, my gosh. Oh, so good.
Did you pour it, or did you just use, like, you know, a honey dipper or something?
Pick a spoon. You know, spoon and kind of drizzle it on.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, you got to do that. Yeah. And, of course, now, you know, if you go to – oh, you go to the state fair or something, you know, they make snow cones with maple syrup. But this is, like I said, this is not snow cone. This is not, you know, it's more candy-like. Snow cones are like snow cones. Yeah.
Well, I'm,
so, and same thing is true with making maple candy, you know, and you can do that. And you know, the little wooden molds or the little, you know, tin molds that you can make maple candy, you just have to keep stirring that candy because if you – do it. I mean, you really want it so that it's creamy, and that's, you know, the, so that it doesn't crystallize and become hard. And that's a whole, you know, you got to have finesse to do that. Yeah, but yeah.
Well,
so, and
I'm
I have.
So glad.
Yeah.
I was just saying, I'm so glad to get some, you know, because I actually there is a recipe for do this in the Little House Cookbook. By Barbara Walker, and I hadn't ever tried it, but I don't think it's said to pack the snow hard. So I'm always glad to get suggestions from people who have actually done stuff and know what they're doing.
Well, I think that whole thing, I mean, people think of maple syrup just going on pancakes, but, you know, the people that are in maple syrup production, I mean, I have a phenomenal salad dressing recipe that's made with maple syrup. You know, you can, like I said, you can use it as a substitute in lots of recipes, but you have to treat it differently than, for example, molasses or something like that, because you want to get that subtle flavor. And I used to, like I said, we hadn't syruped when my husband died. I, like I said, got out of the business. We sold off the evaporator and all that sort of thing. But every spring, not this year because the weather was so lousy, I mean too warm, I would tap about 4 trees. I collect sap, and I had one of those turkey boilers, you know, with the gas, the propane gas, and I would make, you know, maybe a quart of maple syrup and every year just to say that I did because I didn't want to pass it up because it's like I said, it's in your blood. And but then you want to, you know, I wanted to give some to my daughter and my son. And so I gave some to my daughter, and then I found out my son-in-law was using it in his coffee. And I said, no, you can't do that. You cannot put maple. You can put it in tea, but you cannot use it in coffee. I won't give you any more. So, the other thing I wanted to share with you is there are two books. When we got into this, it was there's a book called The Maple Sugar Book, and it's by Helen and Scott Nearing. And it is a wonderful read. They talk about the history. They talk about, you know, the influence of the Indians. They talk about the sugar bush. And it's a wonderful book, and it's just so much fun to read. And that's a neat book. And then one of our other ones was a little book. I don't even know when it was published. I mean, we bought it back in the 60s. And it's called The Amateur Sugar Maker, and it's by a guy by the name of Noel Perrin, P-E-R-R-I-N. Again, a neat little book that talks about how he builds his sugar house and how he's, you know, gotten interested in making maple syrup. And he kind of equates his sugar house to Thoreau. And it's a wonderful little story. And he's got a sugar bush up in Vermont. So, and of course, since then, there's been lots and lots of books on maple syrup, and of course, the commercial syrup producers. It's a whole different realm by using reverse osmosis and plastic tubing and stuff. I mean, we had plastic tubing at the peak of when we were boiling. We had 1,200 taps in.
We were
producing the one winter, the one spring that we topped over 500 gallons of maple syrup, and it was a lot of work, a lot of wood, and to burn. But we had 1,200 taps in, which was pretty good for an amateur, you know, amateur maple syrup production. We called it the Northern Light Maple Syrup Company. Because we can see the Northern Lights from our place, and
really,
and they are, yeah. So,
and about the tubing, if and the reverse osmosis, yeah. if you ever get a chance to see a modern, and now I'm talking to the listeners, if you ever get a chance to see a modern sugar bush, it is completely different. I got to see one that was set up in Northern Ohio a couple years back.
Yeah.
And it was, they have tubes hooked to all the different trees, and then it sort of vacuums the sap
out. They're called sap suckers. They're called sap suckers. And it's a little vacuum pump that they put on, and it actually, you don't need to collect the sap by gravity. One of our systems, it was a gravity drain, so that the tubes went from each spile into a main line, and then you'd collect in a big vat. But then when you had some areas where you didn't have enough elevation, enough drop, we had a vacuum pump on our tubes. Problem we had was the squirrels kept chewing through the tubes because they liked the sweetness of the sap. So we had an all-out war on the squirrels in our area.
Well, I think that happens a lot for various things. And it certainly does seem like maple syrup really does kind of get in the culture. It isn't just the Little House books that have it. There's a Windy Foot book that's all about maple syrup. There's a Miracle on Maple Hill, which is, you know, a classic. It just seems like it's a big part of the culture in that northeastern part of the United States, kind of sliding
it
on
is.
Into the northern Midwest.
Right, and everybody associates it with Vermont, but, of course, you know, New York maple syrup producers, and, of course, Canadian, you know, there's – It's big business. It really is, and they're very protective of the health of environment for maple trees because we've had, you know, some devastation with various kinds of things, and they're very concerned about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we just have been. It's been an entire hour now. Have you realized that?
Well, it's been fun. I'm glad we had a chance to talk. Sometime we'll talk about Jell-O.
Yes, I hope you will come back in and talk about that, Lynn, because I think we've got a lot of good information about maple syrup tonight. It's something that they talk about. You know, it's a couple chapters in Little House in the Big Woods, but it's something that
yeah.
really, I think, stands out for a lot of people. So to hear someone whose family actually was producing SAP back then was a pretty cool chance for everybody. And to learn about the jackdaws, is that how you said it?
Jackwax.
So that is what it's really supposed to be called. So other people will know what we're talking about. That is a good thing.
Okay, and you're gonna let me know. You're gonna email me after you've made some and tell me what you think of it. But make sure you get some dill pickles next to you.
Okay, I will. Thanks, Lynn, and
okay.
Thank you for everybody for listening to this episode of Trundle Bed Tales. I hope that you will remember to brighten the corner where you are and listen for our new episodes next month. Thank you.